The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is a humanitarian catastrophe that is shaped by a market situation. So while there might be food available, there's no money to purchase the food, and the cost of food is extraordinarily high, even for the best of times. So, you know, you imagine a near famine situation and you imagine no food. There is some food, but no one can afford it. Oh, I should add that Locock revised upwards his estimation of the number of people who are actually at risk of famine, which is a category under the UN of about to enter a sort of famine red light zone. It used to be 8.4 million as of September or August. Just 6 weeks later, so to this week on October 22nd, he revised it upwards to almost 14 million.
I'm Matthew Kahn, and you're listening to the Lawfare Podcast, October 30th, 2018. Since 2011, Yemen has transitioned from the scene of a political crisis to one of the worst humanitarian disasters in the world. But how U.S. policy affects the situation is the subject of little discussion. The United States provides intelligence and logistical support to the Saudi and Emirati-led coalition fighting against Iranian-backed Houthis in Yemen, and the conflict implicates the future stability of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the U.S.'s longest-standing ally in the region. To shed light on the complicated dynamic of the conflict, on October 25th, the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution hosted a panel discussion on U.S. policy in Yemen, featuring Brookings Senior Fellows Daniel Byman and Bruce Rydell, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Daphna Rand, and Arabia Foundation senior analyst Fatima Al-Asrar. They talked about the U.S.'s role in the conflict, the extent of the humanitarian crisis, and how the dire conditions on the ground can be alleviated. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 360, U.S. Policy and the Crisis in Yemen.
What I'd like to begin with is simply learning more about Yemen itself. And Fatima, I'd like to ask you to start us off, if you don't mind, which is simply, could you give us a lay of the land about the main players in Yemen itself? So not the regional dynamics that occupy so much attention in Washington, but the tragedy and the fighting that's being borne by the Yemenis. Could you explain to us what we should be thinking about?
Thank you so much, Dan. Thank you for inviting me. I'm really honored to be here. And I thank you for that question, because there has been so much focus on the international or regional aspect of this conflict without really looking at the local dynamics in Yemen, which really threaten Yemen's sovereignty, and without which we cannot really solve Yemen's issues. And I think, you know, the media has been portraying the war in Yemen as maybe a two-sided war between Saudi Arabia and local rebels, but the situation is a little bit more complex than that. So I think it's probably useful a little bit to give the audience some context. Back in 2014, a group known as the Houthis have allied with former President Ali Abdullah Saleh and overtook Yemen shortly after the Arab Spring. The alliance was very peculiar. We were all very baffled by it, because not only were the Houthis and Saleh main adversaries and fiercest of enemies, but also Ali Abdullah Saleh, the former president, had actually killed the leader of the Houthi movement, Hussein Badruddin al-Houthi. At that point, both of them were really seasoned fighters. The Houthis are definitely one of the fiercest fighters in Yemen, and no one was able to stop their influence inside Yemen. They have threatened, you know, political parties. They overthrew the government of Yemen, placed the entire cabinet under house arrest, and ultimately in 2014, in September, they took large amounts of lands. The capital, Sana'a, fell, the seaport of Hudaydah on the west coast. There, you know, Taiz was under siege. Aden was also seeing a lot of fights in the south. And it was really a brutal warfare. And just to put things in perspective, within 6 months of the Houthi-Saleh alliance that took place, about 7,000 people died. And this was long before Saudi-led coalition intervened. These statistics are local statistics from credible organizations in Yemen, and usually the media doesn't report on them, not because of lack of access or information, but perhaps mostly because no one is really interested in telling that part of the story. So the Arab coalition intervention probably has been one of the most horrific or catastrophic for Yemen, because started in March 2015, and it was based on the government of Yemen's request from Saudi Arabia and others to remove the Houthi militia. But it ended up being a quagmire, as we all know. And it was catastrophic because it also added another layer to the conflict on top of the local one. So now you have compounded conflicts in Yemen that are taking place. And of course, also no one really thought that the Houthis were going to be intimidated by this. In fact, Houthis just really love fighting. During their war with President Saleh, they really made a mockery of Yemen's army. Kids that were, you know, 6 years old would put hand grenades in tanks in the battlefield, and you know, it was just it was dirty guerrilla warfare, and they spared no ugly tactic in this war. And so on the outset, Saudi Arabia always claims that they are helping Yemen, and surely they do in a lot of aspects, in economic and political assistance. But the military campaign for them is truly about their national security. The Houthis are supported by Iran economically, financially, through the media. We've recently seen also the Houthis have increased in their use of sophisticated weaponry, which, you know, tribesmen from you know, the Houthi highlands, you'd wonder where would they have access to these weaponries. They've been able to attack the USS Cole in 2016. They planted a lot of sea mines on the Red Sea. And they've had a really destructive role based all on really Iranian sponsorship, as it has been proven. But since the coalition intervened, the Houthis have been effectively pushed back from many areas in Yemen. Initially, they had 90% of the land. Now they control about 30%, but that 30% is heavily controlled population centers. So this is where you're seeing a lot of the mismanagement, a lot of the corruption, a lot of the images of the famine, the diseases that are happening. They're mostly happening in Houthi areas. In, you know, liberated areas, the situation really depends. It's not really prosperity. Every situation in Yemen is different. So some areas in the north, like Ma'rib and Al Jawf, have been a bit of success story. They have about over a million internally displaced people from Yemen, including their own population. And the economy there has been booming. They've been doing very well since they were able to get rid of the militia. And I think that Saudis are playing a constructive role in that area, not only economically, but through also stopping the ballistic missiles on landing in Ma'rib, which the Houthis launch almost on a daily basis. and they stop them through the U.S. Patriot missile systems. These areas in the north are aligned with the government of Yemen, of course, and with that, there comes that benefits of that alliance. The south is an entirely different story. The south has been, is liberated. They don't have the Houthis, but they have terrible economic conditions, and they're really suffering from government neglect. But also the south detests the government of Yemen because they are secessionists to the core. Yemen, for those who don't know, it used to be two countries, north and south, and they united in 1990. And as soon as 1993, like just 3 years later, the south wanted secession because they felt that the treaty of unity did not really respect them. And they felt exploited afterwards. Now, the problem in the south is that you have the Southern Transitional Council. You have elements in the south that are confronting the state. And I think this is really a ticking time bomb. If we are going to have peace between, you know, the international level, between Saudi Arabia and the Houthis, or the government and the Houthis, the south has a huge destabilization effect. And just to put things in perspective, in 1986, there was a brief civil war, south-south civil war, that claimed the lives of 10,000 people in 3 months. So currently there is a more or less a constructive role that is being played by the coalition, because somewhat the southerners are more aligned with the coalition than actually with their own government. And they also found there's an interesting dynamic there with the role of the United Arab Emirates in the south, as they have cultivated a special relationship based on perhaps the Emiratis' disdain for the Islah Party, which is closely affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood. And they also fight ISIS and Al-Qaeda, which has been very active in the south to bring a destabilizing effect in liberated areas. But this, it just made the relationship between the Yemeni government of Hadi and the UAE go sour. So it's an interesting dynamic to really watch. And, you know, it also brought a lot of theories that the UAE is interested in the south and perhaps in secession for its own interest because of the ports that are there in the south and the economic resources and so on and so forth. And I was mentioning to Bruce earlier on that there's another element that often we don't think about, is that there's actually close familial ties between United Arab Emirates and the Southerners. Many Southerners in the 70s migrated to UAE, and it's you know, some of the fighters that we know are in Yemen, UAE fighters, have actually families in Hadramaut and Aden and elsewhere. So somewhat the fate of the region is, or the fate of Yemen is really closely aligned with the Gulf allies. And finally, and really briefly, well, or maybe not, I just want to talk about the Houthis and just the living conditions under Houthi-controlled areas, which somewhat maintain a facade of functionality and security. Houthis have a really strong grip on the areas that they control. You can roam Sana'a without checkpoints, unlike Aden, where there are checkpoints every mile. And the reason for that is because they're really becoming more of a totalitarian police state. I had a friend who was visiting Sana'a, and she was visiting her family. And, you know, at night, someone knocked on the door and said, "Who's on the third floor?" So people really, everything, nothing goes there without people knowing about it. There's a culture of fear over there. And, you know, we see the images of the famine and destruction and, you know, the cholera, while the Houthi leadership are living a very privileged lifestyle. And this is really heartbreaking. And I want to mention as well that there is no consent for the Houthis. I mean, there is some consent for the Houthis, there is some popularity, but by large, the Houthis have alienated most of their supporters, including, and especially after they have killed their one-time ally, President Saleh. They killed him last year in December after he just had an alliance with them. President Saleh felt that the Houthis were not respecting their power sharing agreement, and that they wanted to completely control the government and state institutions. One thing that I feel is missing from or misunderstood about Yemen and the Houthi role is the Houthi's doctrine, which is based on a sectarian genealogical supremacy. The Houthis believe that only the people of the household of Prophet Muhammad, which are called Ahl al-Bayt, are eligible to rule Yemen. So this is really the tragedy in Yemen's current history. There's an indoctrination. I mean, I don't know if I should call it sectarian coercion, because it's really so narrowed on the Ahl al-Bayt issue. So I think this is extremely dangerous as they're enforcing this. And I often explain this phenomena, this religious phenomena and selectiveness as drawing striking parallels to Gilead of the Handmaid's Tale, really. And even like the Houthis have things, have Aunt Lydia's, you know, they call them the Zainabiyat in Yemen, where these women would, you know, storm homes of people and look into the women's cell phones to make sure that they're not saying anything bad against the Houthis, to make sure that they're in check. I know during a demonstration in October 6th, which was a demonstration in Sana'a on famine and hunger, one of the girls who was from the University of Sana'a got arrested, and she told us privately the story of how one of these women just violated her. And as she tried to protest, the woman bit her cheek and arm. So we're seeing things that we haven't seen in Yemen. It's a moral an unprecedented moral decay to the social fabric. And this goes on as long as there is this lawlessness permeating around. I guess if I wanted, I wanted to just say that the Houthis have been somewhat portrayed in the media as, you know, legitimate actors or indigenous minorities. And I think that, this is just a huge mischaracterization. They did have a legitimate grievance, but then again, they allied with their chief, violator. So what does that tell you about them? I think that, you know, in an effort to improve the situation in Yemen, there has been a lot of mischaracterization. In an effort to say Saudi Arabia shouldn't be intervened, a lot of inaccuracies have been just all reported in the media. What has been really frustrating for me as a Yemeni watching this conflict and watching people reporting on it is that the international community has really been silent on Houthi violations. I would say the most disappointing was the recent UN Human Rights Report that was issued in August, where there was no mention at all to the fact that the Houthis have killed thousands of people in Aden. Not only that, but there was no mention that the Houthis have landmines in Yemen. It's one of the biggest landmine operations since World War II, and it's going to continue to affect generations for years to come. So this is also why when the Associated Press reported on, you know, the violations and the torture of the prisoners, dozens of prisoners in UAE-backed prisons in the south, they failed to even mention in a footnote that there are 7,000 Yemeni prisoners in Houthi militia's prisons. 2,500 are journalists. So people are really afraid of speaking up. They're not really vocal, and we're trying to, maybe through just giving you this alternate view of the conflict and the local dynamic, understand the complexity of the Houthis militia in Yemen. There's so much to say, like, about the humanitarian aid and the way that it's being delivered and the role of Saudi Arabia, but I'll leave that just some room for the other speakers.
Thank you. And that's really a kind of fantastic foundation for us to build our broader conversation. But I want to take your last point and extend on it. And Daphna, if I could ask you about the humanitarian situation, which, you know, was always extremely difficult in the best of times and is now off the cliff. And if I could ask you not just about the humanitarian situation, but what might be done about, not just by the U.S. government, but by other governments, by the U.S. Congress, by humanitarian organizations?
Sure, great. Thank you very much to Brookings, to Dan, to Natan, to the whole community here for inviting, for hosting the panel, for inviting me. There's statistics to answer your question, and then there's analysis. Maybe I'll start with a few really shocking statistics and then answer your question by analyzing some of the solutions. Just this week, the Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs at the UN, Mark Lowcock, gave his briefing on Yemen and provided the most up-to-date figures. The UN holds the pen on sort of collating the numbers on the humanitarian crises. Let me share a few of these just to, not to hyperbolize how tragic and this humanitarian catastrophe is, but just to relay the statistics. Out of a population of 28 million, 22.2 million are now in need of humanitarian aid in Yemen. That's across the country. 19 million of the population lack clean water. There are 1.2 million cases of cholera, although we believe that's actually a low estimate. And 16.4 million people lack access to health care. And that's a combination of there's no doctors in their community and they can't actually physically access the hospitals. And then the third reason is that the health medical sites have been destroyed. I want to emphasize on these statistics that the situation has decreased, has dramatically decreased this year and since 2018. This is a humanitarian catastrophe that is shaped by a market situation. So that while there might be food available, there's no money to purchase the food, and the cost of food is extraordinarily high, even for the best of times. So, you know, you imagine a near famine situation and you imagine no food. There is some food, but no one can afford it. Oh, I should add that Lowcock revised upwards his estimation of the number of people who are actually at risk of famine, which is a category under the UN of about to enter a sort of famine red light zone. It used to be 8.4 million as of September or August. Just 6 weeks later, so to this week on October 22nd, he revised it upwards to almost 14 million. So, and I'll get to what's changed in the past 6 months that has really exponentially decreased or dramatically made the situation deteriorate even from really tragic levels of a humanitarian situation. There's been a 35% increase in the food prices just since January 2018, so just in the past 10 months. And just to give you guys a flavor for what this means, if a family of seven is asking for a food basket of the sort that Mercy Corps or other implementers might give, the food basket consists of wheat, flour, dry beans, oil, sugar, and salt. That's it. That's the food basket for seven people. The price of that has increased 25% in the past couple of months. And a lot of the price increase for some of the basic food is highly correlated with the price of fuel. The two are in limbo and affecting each other economically. The price of fuel has skyrocketed. So let's talk a little bit about what's happened in the past 6 months to 8 months to really affect these figures. In July, there was the beginning of the offensive in Hodeidah. And, you know, although there was a pause in the fighting in Hodeidah City and the port area, and the media has been correct in sort of analyzing that pause, the fighting continues across that governorate. That's a very important for humanitarian access issues. As people know, the Hodeidah port and Salif port associated are the main humanitarian access points for the entire country. 80% of all humanitarian goods get through those ports. So the fighting in the transfer lane, so in the transit areas and the whole Hodeidah governance have cut off road access between the port city, even if the fighting has subsided to the rest of Yemen, including northern Yemen, where, you know, a vast majority of the population is living. So imagine roads that are just barred and the trucks can't go through. And that explains a lot of the new figures from the past 6 to 8 weeks. So offer that. I would just also offer that the Sana'a airport is a key transit point for humanitarian aid and has been closed by the Saudi-led coalition since the beginning of the war. And that is an obvious solution here, is to reopen that airport for entry of humanitarian goods. And that's a solution that the UN has called for and is part of the negotiations with the special envoy. So in addition to the governorate, the fighting in the governorate, the number of IDPs in the governorate has increased, and that is leading to sort of the deterioration of the humanitarian situation writ large. Since the fighting began in Hodeidah, there's 500,000 new IDPs in the past couple of months, and they're fleeing everywhere. So that just gives you a flavor for the humanitarian situation. I could go on and on. I don't want to, but I want to answer the second part of the question, which are the solutions and how Congress has dealt with it, and to, you know, to commend the UN and the UN Special Envoy and the humanitarian organizer who have taken a lead to some extent in the international system, and also the many, many donors around the world, including the US government, who've responded with humanitarian aid. But unfortunately, the humanitarian aid, just the donations of food and fuel and water and medicine is not sufficient. The issue is really the access. The issue is the ports being opened at full capacity. Last year in November of 2017, there was a complete blockade of Hodeidah Port that through international pressure, including by the Trump administration, that was alleviated a little bit. But the extent of port access is still far below pre-2017 level. So that means in 11 months, there's been a decrease in the coalition's ability to permit ships into that port of Hodeidah. So that's an obvious solution, is to increase the humanitarian capacity of the port, to open the airport, et cetera. And that those are really the solution set for the humanitarian crisis involves access, in addition to obviously the food aid and the other aid itself. Congress has focused on three basic responses to this humanitarian tragedy. And the oversight and engagement and levels of discussion in Congress have been really unprecedented. And, you know, I would argue Yemen now features as one of top four foreign affairs issues that are across the desk of many members of Congress, members of the Senate from both parties. It's become a bipartisan issue. So let me offer the three ways that Congress has responded and then stop there so we can hear from Bruce. The three main sort of lines of oversight have been in responding both to the humanitarian catastrophe, but also to U.S. engagement in the war and support for the Saudi-led coalition, have been to focus on first the war powers issues, the authorization of the use of force, Congress now has a number of bills, but the question has been in Congress, you know, have we, Congress, authorized executive branch to support this particular civil conflict as separate from U.S. operations against al-Qaeda and other CT counterterrorism issues in Yemen. So that question is arising and will continue to arise probably through the next period politically. The second type of questions have been about discrete arms sales. Now, the process is that the State Department will notify the Senate on foreign military sales on discrete items. Usually these congressional notifications are really boring rubber stamps. This happens for around the world. This is not a big deal. There's a guy or a couple men and women in the Senate who look at it. But over the past 2 or 3 years, this has become a huge hook for oversight, particularly looking at items that are being sold through foreign military sales to members of the coalition. So there have actually been roll call votes of disapproval on discrete items being sold to members of the coalition where there's a belief that either that the item has a direct effect in the war in Yemen, and in some cases even a roll call vote on an item that had nothing to do with the war in Yemen in 2016. So that has been a line of oversight and leverage that has gained a lot of congressional attention and will continue to do so. And the third is the most recent legislative activity around the Department of Defense support militarily and logistical support for the coalition. So this is the actual manifestation of U.S. support in a real time, which is the refueling and logistical support. And congressional activity has focused on conditioning this U.S. support on better behavior, better actions by the coalition. So the conditionality argument is essentially that if Congress forces the executive branch to pressure the allies in the coalition to increase humanitarian access, to be more careful on the civilian and the targeting of civilians in the air operations and in the ground offensives, and to press harder towards a negotiation toward a political settlement, then the leverage afforded by U.S. support for the coalition, the U.S. is not in the coalition, but is militarily supporting the coalition, which is an important distinction, that this leverage will change behavior. And the certification language in the National Defense Authorization Act of last year explicitly requested that the Secretary of State certify that there have been progress along all three lines: humanitarian access, civilian casualty, more care and regard and decrease in civilian casualties, and then efforts towards political resolution. And the Secretary of State, of course, in a controversial move, certified that there had been progress toward all three. And I'd end by just noting that the way that legislative oversight, that sort of third bucket of legislative oversight was worded, it offers the executive branch, or it demands that the executive branch will again have to report in both every 3 months, so every 180 days. So there will be at least two more rounds of these certification. And I query whether, given the deterioration of the situation, really literally in the past 6 to 8 weeks, if anyone honestly can make the case about especially the humanitarian access and the decrease in civilian casualties, with the final caveat that in August, shortly before the certification, it was the deadliest month in terms of civilian casualties since the war began, with 500 civilians being killed, including, of course, the tragedy with the school school bus in northern Yemen that many people read about in the media. So I would end with that, that note that the certification is due back to Congress again in 3 months and 6 months.
Thank you. That's painfully sobering for all of us. Bruce, I wanted to turn to you with all this in mind, which is simply, can you explain U.S. policy towards Yemen? The International Crisis Group did a report a while back that called U.S. policy a yellow light of kind of both trying to stop some of the actions in the of other powers, but at the same time being permissive. And I'd love to get your take on how to think about what the United States is trying to achieve or simply what's been going on over the years.
If U.S. policy was a yellow light 2 years ago, it's a green light right now. The United States, as a general rule, since 1946, when Harry Truman sent the first American delegation to northern Yemen, has been that we don't have a Yemen policy. We have a Saudi policy, that the highest levels of the administration focus on tremendously, including the president. And then Yemen is kind of a subset of that. There are advantages of this. U.S. ambassadors in Yemen usually tend to have a lot of freedom of maneuver because no one is really watching back in Washington what they're doing, since there are no political appointees to want to become ambassador to Sana'a. We end up with real professional diplomats who actually know what they're doing. But there are a lot of downsides of this. And the biggest downside is that essentially whatever Saudi Arabia wants to do in Yemen, the United States supports. There have been some rare exceptions to this. John F. Kennedy in 1962 and 1963 refused to support the Saudi-inspired insurgency against the Republican government, told the Saudis that they needed to reform. He actually set the ball and trained for some modest reforms. Bill Clinton had a brief moment of not listening to the Saudis during the Southern Civil War in the early 1990s. But as a general rule, American presidents have endorsed whatever the Saudis want to do. Since 2015 and the start of the Saudi-led coalition war, that has meant supporting the coalition warfare effort. Daphne has already mentioned the kinds of military assistance we provide, inter-air refueling, some intelligence support. But the most important one is not new arms sales. It is the continuation of existing arms sales. The Saudi Air Force must get spare parts, technical upgrades, maintenance, expertise, you name it, jet tires, from the United States every single day in order to operate. If that flow of spare parts came to a close tonight, the Royal Saudi Air Force would be grounded tomorrow morning, or at least those aircraft that are American supplied. The other aircraft are supplied by the United Kingdom. So the U.S. and the United Kingdom have tremendous leverage here if they want to do it. But it was more than military support and more than the ongoing logistics supply line. The United States also endorsed Saudi diplomacy, and in particular supported the UN Security Council Resolution 2216, which guides the UN mediation effort and which kind of sets the international tone for what is proper in Yemen. UN Security Council Resolution 2216 is completely unbalanced. It is basically written by the Saudi government and then presented to the council by one of its partners in the war at the time, then Jordan. Jordan has more or less dropped out of the war since then. The resolution is essentially the Saudi indictment of the Houthi Ali Abdullah Saleh coalition. It sanctions the Houthis, it sanctions Saleh. It is so unbalanced that, in my judgment, is actually a barrier to peace, not a pathway to peace. I think it is safe to say that the UN people involved in the negotiations also recognize this today, although, of course, they're very careful not to say that in public. The resolution passed 14-0. Only one country abstained, and that was Russia. Rarely can you point to the Russians being the wise voice in international diplomacy, but in this case, I think the Russians probably had it right. It's going to be very, very hard to pull this back. If the Obama administration supported the coalition, I think it's safe to say that it did so with a great deal of reluctance. And there was a real desire to see if we can't somehow adjust the course coming up to 2016 to minimize the damage caused by this. In the end, they didn't. There was some important moves to control the munitions flow, but in the end, those didn't really stop the war. There are complex reasons why the Obama administration supported the Saudis. I think they almost all have to do with Iran. But if the Obama administration was somewhat reluctant and kept hoping that maybe they could find a way out, Donald Trump has shown no reluctance whatsoever. He has doubled down on the bet here. He has endorsed the Saudis completely, and as a consequence, he has endorsed the war completely. There is a fantasy in the Trump administration that somehow if the Saudis are able to defeat the Houthis, this will be a mortal blow to the government of Iran. This is a complete fantasy. For Iran, Yemen is a magnificent strategic opportunity to bog down their number one and number two enemy, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, in a quagmire that they hope will go on forever. For good reason. It costs the Saudis at least $50 billion a year to continue the war they're fighting in Yemen. You want to know why Saudi Arabia is the third largest defense budget in the world? Because it's in a war in Yemen that costs it a fortune. The amount of money that Iran provides to the Houthis is an unknown quantity, but it's safe to say it's a pittance in characterization to the $50 billion. To give you another example, one that Jamal Khashoggi brought up, the Houthis are firing ballistic missiles basically made in automotive shop repair factories in Sana'a, which cost maybe a few tenths of thousands of dollars at most, with assistance from Hezbollah and Iran. They have all been successfully shot down by Patriot missiles since this began. Each Patriot missile cost $3 million to fire at a Houthi ballistic missile. If you were the CEO of any corporation in the world, you would say, get me out of this mess. But so far, that hasn't happened. The main reason for that, I think it is safe to say, is Mohammed bin Salman. The Saudi war in Yemen is Mohammed bin Salman's signature policy initiative. He embarked upon it shortly after he became defense minister. I think it is safe to say that the Saudis panicked when they saw the Houthis advancing on Aden, when they saw the Houthis doing some really foolish things, like announcing that there were going to be air service direct between Sana'a and Tehran. Not that air service is all that bad, but it was kind of sticking it into the Saudis right at the point that they're going to be most likely to react. The panic resulted in a war effort that has no strategy, that has no achievable end state. It was supposed to be Operation Decisive Storm in order to attract all of you who were Desert Storm supporters. It was changed from Decisive Storm pretty quickly when it became clear that there was not going to be anything decisive about it. If you go back and look at the videos and the news coverage of the war in its first month, Mohammed bin Salman's picture was in everything. He was everywhere. Now, I have nothing to do with it. But he has everything to do with it. His prestige is linked to the outcome of this war, and he needs some kind of victory, whatever that is to be done. Now, of course, it is also tied up in the whole question of what happened to Jamal Khashoggi, and the Istanbul murder investigation, probably the murder investigation of the century that we're looking at. There is an opportunity in all of this, I think, for the United States, and the opportunity is to refocus attention on Yemen and focus attention on ending the war in Yemen as quickly as possible. Jamal, in his last op-ed, called for a very simple solution. Saudi Arabia and its allies to announce a unilateral ceasefire to halt all airstrikes, all military activity on the ground, lift the blockade immediately, not partially, but absolutely immediately, and convene, he suggested in Taif in Saudi Arabia, a conference of all the Yemeni parties, the Houthis, the secessionists, everyone, to try to come up with a new solution. The odds that this would necessarily result in an agreement among the Yemeni parties, as I think you've laid out pretty clearly, is not good, but at least it would get us off the battlefield and into the negotiating table. I don't see much chance that the Trump administration is going to do this. They haven't shown much interest in trying to find a political solution. As I said earlier, I think they live in the fantasy world that somehow this is going to strike a blow to Iran that will be mortal and crippling. But I do think that the Congress of the United States has an opportunity here, and Daphne has nicely laid out what the Congress is looking at. Now is the time for the Congress to take the big step and cut that spare parts logistical line and compel an end to this war. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bruce. I want to begin asking questions really by highlighting what I feel are kind of different emphases that you and Fatima have in terms of outside powers and the relations to the Yemeni players themselves. And Fatima, my sense from you is that you're concerned about the Houthis and the authoritarian nature of their rule, some of the barbarities they prosecuted, that you are very concerned about their victory, and thus perhaps may want the Saudi and UAE intervention to continue in order to ensure that victory does not happen. And Bruce, the opposite question, which is, if outside powers do withdraw, does that mean the Houthis triumph, and does that mean that Iran wins? And how should we think about both of those? So Fatima, if I can ask you to start.
Yeah, I mean, look, I do agree with Bruce with a lot of things, surprisingly, actually. So for example, in thinking about the way this war was conducted, the airstrikes, I'm really not a huge fan. I mean, with the Pentagon, about maybe a month or 2 months ago, releasing that about, 6,000 civilian casualties in Syria as a result of its air campaign with ISIS, it just does not give me any hope in bombs or anybody's targeting capacity. So I don't think that that's the solution there. But I think that, you know, listen to what Bruce said in terms of, like, how cheap it is for Iran to make the Houthis antagonize Saudi Arabia and provoke it, mm-hmm. and how disproportionate of a response is, how much money is being spent to exhaust Saudi Arabia, to even exhaust its image. It's at its worst at the time being. There's nothing that can fix Saudi Arabia's image with what's going on. Mm-hmm. All they need is, you know, one school bus or the death of a child for this to bring back the role of Saudi Arabia as a huge violator. And they're not Boy Scouts, though. The Houthis and the Iranians are just doing a lot of malice in Yemen, but doing it very strategically. And the United States and the Saudis have got, and the government of Yemen, because it does have some agency, they've got to sit together and figure out how to strategically combat this the way that the Iran is doing it. So, I mean, for Iran, this doesn't cost them a thing. It's not their major issue, but it's a card they play. They are, I believe, effectively stalling peace. So in September, the UN envoy, Martin Griffith, who's currently in town, had initially put, you know, got agreements from everybody to come and sit down together for peace talks in September 6th. And guess what? Come September 6th, and the Houthis are not there, and they don't want to participate in Geneva. I suspect it's based on orders from Iran. You know, it's because what do they have to lose? They control heavily populated centers for which the Arab coalition, the Yemeni government, cannot take back without it being bloody. And they know this. I mean, that's a huge card that they play in their hand. So, you know, for the Arab coalition, I mean, to liberate Hudaydah or Sana'a would be like synonymous with destroying Hudaydah or Sana'a if they're doing it with air campaign. This is why I somewhat supported the Hudaydah attacks, because we hoped that there were not going to be air campaigns, and because there was a huge fighting force that developed in the past 3 years through not only just the southern brigades, but also through defected elements of former President Saleh, who have been fighting alongside the Houthis. So we thought that's a clever strategy. You know, use the fighting forces to just, you know, weaken the Houthis, who are already weakened by far. They have no alliances at the moment. The Houthis have no alliances with the General People's Congress, which is Saleh's party. They have no alliance with Islah Party, which is the biggest party that we have in Yemen. Zero sympathies in the south of Yemen. The tribes around Sana'a have all been violated by the Houthis, and they want the opportunity to just drive them away from there. In Hudaydah, which, like, people of Hudaydah are just really simple and nice people, they don't, you know, they don't want to see the Houthis there. And in the areas that you've mentioned, A WFP truck was delivering around the Durehimi. They were delivering food assistance to areas that were deprived from food, just to help in emergency situation. And what we saw on was a video of the Houthi militia striking the WFP truck while chanting "Death to America." Right. So this is killing their own population under their control. And I think that this is an element again, and I think, you know, in talking about the humanitarian catastrophe that is generated in Yemen, they are using famine. I mean, Houthis are effectively using famine. I'm not saying here that the coalition is not, you know, has not restricted access. The blockade was a 1 month blockade, but I think it generated much more, you know, fuss than actually what happened. But the market in Yemen is, I mean, I had a friend who went to Yemen, and she's like, listen, the food is all around. So what are you talking about, a famine? And it was not the matter of, you know, access to food as much as, you know, Daphna said, it's the purchasing power. And in here, I think that not humanitarian organizations, but we ought to really rethink the way that we're doing aid. No one is interested in development in Yemen. No one is interested in, you know, economic empowerment for what's going on, because they think that that's a step that should come after the war ends. But we don't know when the war is going to end. There are so many ways that we could try to help the local populations. And, you know, we're not even getting that right at the very moment. People are being employed in the armies, both for the Houthi militia and the Arab coalition, because that's becoming like the biggest source of employment in Yemen. And if we give them, you know, an economic opportunity, perhaps they'll turn away from, you know, using the guns. But I don't think people here in the United States or policymakers really think that the Houthis could be defeated. I think the Houthis, they think if they have one single soldier left, they're still victors. They think that, you know, they're holding the political process. And they realize their power in holding this political process. I think that we need to be aware of this. We need to hold them responsible, just as we're holding the Saudi-led coalition responsible for a lot of things that are happening. But just remain vigilant, because ultimately, this is sad, but, you know, maybe the intervention has been a mixed blessing, because perhaps if the Saudis haven't intervened, you wouldn't have heard about Yemen and discussed it in, you know, with such passion today, just wanting to see a better outcome. If there's a lot of, I want to see peace. I worry if peace is going to be just a document that people sign and then worry about the consequences later. The thousands of people that are dying from just guerrilla warfare or street warfares don't generate the same amount of press in the news. So this is really terrifying. What's going on in Yemen?
Bruce, if I could ask you to think about this question as well. And if there were to be some success in removing the Saudi and UAE role, would this be a Houthi victory, an Iranian victory? How do we think about, you know, Iran winning, if you will?
From the standpoint of international public opinion, Iran won this war 3 years ago. The Saudis have become the bad guy. I completely agree with Fatima. The Houthis are not good guys. These are ruthless thugs who want to create a dictatorship for a very small minority of the Zaidi Shia people. But the Saudis have given them the pass. In the United States, of course, there's very little focus on the war at all. If you watch American news stations, you rarely see a story on Yemen. But when you do, what's it all about? Saudi bombing, Saudi blockade. It's not about the intricacies of Yemeni politics. It's not about whether Hadi is a legitimate government or not. It's all about the Saudi blockade. And I also agree with you. I think the Iranians have been telling the Houthis for a while now, fight to the last Houthi, or fight to the last Yemeni. We're all for it. If you keep doing this for another 20 years, Saudi Arabia will be broke. The Saudis have mistakenly maneuvered themselves into the position where all the blame is on them and very, very little blame is on anyone else. That's not a mark of very astute strategy and policy. That's a mark of recklessness and, frankly, stupidity. There's a lot of stupidity involved in how they've gotten into this mess now. This is a critical moment. They could pivot out. take the topic away from what happened in Istanbul and take it to, we're coming to a closure. Will the end of the coalition warfare lead to peace in Yemen? No, of course not. It's hard to see how peace in Yemen can come in terms of an agreement between all the parties. I personally think the most likely outcome that works in the long term is to go back to two Yemens or maybe three Yemens.
Two is good.
I like Yemen so much, I'd like to have three Yemens. That's going to take an awful long time to get there in a peaceful way. Saudis are also making another big mistake. They think that lobbying campaigns in the United States can persuade Americans to like Saudi Arabia. I've got bad news for you. Americans don't like Saudi Arabia. They may not like Iran, but they don't like Saudi Arabia a lot. The overwhelming majority of Americans believe that Saudi Arabia had something to do with 9/11, and all the protestations since then haven't convinced them. The sword of Damocles is hanging over the U.S.-Saudi relationship, and it's in a courtroom in New York. The Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act allows the survivors and victims of 9/11 to sue the government of Saudi Arabia. It's well worth reading the indictment. They got some good lawyers. They don't make claims like Bandar's wife funded it or silly things like that. They make very astute claims that Saudi Arabia allowed funding to go to Al-Qaeda up to and including the day of September 11th and therefore are responsible for negligence. I cannot imagine a jury in the city of New York that isn't going to find Saudi Arabia guilty. So if you think we have a crisis in U.S.-Saudi relations now, wait till that day comes. And Donald Trump's not in a particularly good position to say, I want to do something about this. He supported JASTA, and so did Hillary Clinton.
But there's an important point there. Saudi Arabia does not antagonize the United States as Iran does. It does not perceive it as an enemy. There has been, you know, mistakes that Saudi Arabia has committed in the past. So, you know, I think about it like, you know, the Game of Thrones where the septs have risen, you know, unintentionally when Cersei wanted to manipulate them, and then she realized that she can't necessarily control them. And I think something similar to that happened in Saudi Arabia. You know, I know there's a lot of blame to go around Mohammed bin Salman, and it's really interesting. But what is the pulse of the street in Saudi Arabia? They initially saw him as a young member who is aligned with them, who's, you know, bringing things like, I mean, I used to complain a lot about saying, okay, look, like Yemenis are better. We have freedoms here in Yemen and, you know, women can drive and they can drive in Saudi Arabia. So I felt a little bit jealous that there's a war in my country and now women can drive in Saudi Arabia. But I mean, Saudi Arabia has a long way to go, you know, with things like, again, the imprisonment of Raif al-Badawi or, you know, the other women activists or, I think there are so many ways where they can reform culturally, but as a Yemeni citizen, you know, where I find that I have different values, than the ones that Saudi Arabia has, because we grew up in Yemen believing in a pluralistic system. One of the things I realized too is that Yemen could not have survived without the economic support of Saudi Arabia throughout the years. And as you mentioned, the war in 1962, when the revolutionaries in Yemen overthrew the imamate system, the Zaydis, and it's kind of funny because the Saudis have supported the monarchs back then. And so around that time, the Saudi, after 8 years of a bloody conflict, the Saudis withdrew, and the revolutionaries took over. And despite the fact that they were fighting each other for 8 years, 2 years later, the Yemeni government went to Saudi Arabia and asked for an economic package because they realized that they could not survive without it. So there are things that are important to the, I think if Yemen is to survive this famine, It cannot happen without support from the Saudis. In the humanitarian conference, both the Saudis and the Emiratis pledged $1 billion. And there is some statistic out there that, you know, it's over $15 billion of aid that has come from the Saudis for a very long time. Is this aid efficient, effective? I think it could it could be better than what it is today.
Let me pass this to Daphna with this question, right? Which is, we've seen a lot of talk, right? And we've seen a lot of talk from regional governments, and we've seen a lot of talk from the United States. And to kind of highlight a issue that both Bruce and Fatima have raised, which is, even if there's brilliant diplomacy in the next year or two, this war is not going away. So we've seen this war precede the Trump administration, and who knows how long this administration will be in office, but it's quite possible that in 2 years or in 6 years, this war will still be going on. As someone who has served in a different administration, what are some of the kind of issues that have come up that you feel are eternal to U.S. policy as opposed to particular to this administration?
Sure. Thank you for that question. Before I do so, I would just note that this is an interesting conversation, and it's really important for a deliberation of Yemen to recognize that it's actually two different issues. What is the end goal in Yemen? What will bring peace? How to resolve the civil conflict is a very complicated topic that really deep experts of Yemen, probably if you got them in a room, wouldn't all agree on, but we could debate. The second question, which we're also kind of dancing around, but just to be explicit, is what should be the U.S. role in the civil conflict as opposed to other U.S. interests, other U.S. objectives in Yemen and the region? So just to differentiate between those two points, and I think that leads to answer your question looking backwards in time. And Dan, and Bruce is right that this was a ambivalent, contested, yellow light decision in 2015. No one ever felt 100% comfortable with this halfway decision. It was a responsive decision. The Gulf partners came and said, please help us support our offensive. We're going ahead. They didn't say, what do you think? But they said, can you sign up to support us? That was the phraseology or the way it came about. We're going ahead anyway. Please support us. And the thinking at the time, and I, you know, this was way above my pay grade as a deputy assistant secretary of state, but the thinking at the time was that there was a deep, deep critique by these partners in the Gulf of U.S. Support for them. This was after 4 or 5 years of the Arab Spring, where there was a sense that the U.S. had abdicated traditional alliances and partnerships in the Middle East. A sense of betrayal was on the tip of the tongue every time we had diplomatic meetings with these partners. The first 10 minutes was in listening mode, thinking about, you know, hearing the real deep sense of betrayal. This was in the context of the JCPOA, the deliberation over the nuclear deal. This was in the context of a discussion of U.S. policy where the U.S. was trying to make the case that it was only negotiating over the nuclear file. That was the term we use, as opposed to Iran's other treacherous behavior. So there was a very concerted effort to make it clear to allies and all over the world, but also particularly in the Gulf, that the U.S. was only deliberating or negotiating the JCPOA over the nuclear issue. So in all that context, when presented with a request by the Gulf partners to support, the response was yes, but in a very limited fashion. And I do believe that was the original mistake, right? The sense that you can actually support an offensive and a campaign in a kind of sort of way. Again, the U.S. did not join the coalition. There was 8 or 9 states that joined the coalition. The U.S. did not. The U.S. supported what they thought at the time, very limited military support, the refueling, intelligence, targeting support, et cetera, that's been written about. And then subsequently, from 2015 until the day the Obama appointees left the buildings we were in, there was an effort to caveat that support, to condition it. We spent months debating the precision-guided munition sales, and ultimately, as Bruce noted, the very last decision in December 2016 by the Obama administration was to pause on that sale. So it was contested, it was conflicted, it was always thought of as kind of a limited sense of support. But the mistake was really not, it was really in setting the limits, right? The partners had said that the offensive to retake Sana'a would take 6 weeks. And there could have been an option to say, okay, you have U.S. support for 6 weeks, right? That there could have been a time-boundedness to the limited support for this offensive. So the lesson, as you asked, the general lesson for U.S. foreign policy is, A, there's no such thing as kind of sort of supporting a coalition that goes to war in the Middle East. U.S. credibility is immediately on the line. U.S. signaling, you know, the argument by the partner was you need to show U.S. credibility and credible commitments to your partners for security guarantees, right? This is important in international relations. But the counter argument is when you go and support a war and you put your name to it, your credibility globally is associated with the conduct, the operations, the strategy, and the policy decisions associated with the offensive. And as Bruce has said, there was never a thoughtful discussion of how it ends, what the strategy is, and even down to the targeting questions with the no-strike list, et cetera. So that was the lesson, is that you can't do this halfway. And I think that's an incredibly important lesson for U.S. national security going forward.
Thank you. This has, for me at least, and I think for all of us, been an incredibly sobering morning as we walk out to enjoy the rest of what seems to be a truly beautiful day. I ask us all, please, to remember the tragedy that is happening really before the world's eyes, in not just today, but I suspect in the weeks and months and years to come. We've had an excellent primer on how to think about Yemen, the problems, the difficulties, the disagreements. So please join me in thanking our panel for an excellent presentation.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the Center for Middle East Policy for holding the panel. If you haven't yet, please take a moment to share the Lawfare Podcast on Facebook or Twitter and give it a rating and review wherever you found us. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music, as always, is performed by Sophia Yan. Until next time, thanks for listening.